Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. So as is my custom, when I enjoy the privilege of travel, I like to bring something back home with me to share with this community, because who we are and what we do at the table is just never very far away from my thoughts. You know that old joke about somebody's going on a trip and you're like, listen, just put me in your suitcase. I promise I'll be quiet. Like, just that sounds great. Just take me along. The community hasn't necessarily asked me to do that. You may not even like that idea, but I do it anyway. You're all in my suitcase. Like, it's just how it is. I tend to take the community with me wherever I go. A little bit hard to explain at border crossings, but so far they've always let me go. So on this particular trip, the largest part of our time was spent in the Chamonix Valley in the French Alps. I'm going to add a little travelogue aspect to this in the sense that there will be a couple of pictures, so you can't really talk about travel without a map, right? So that's where that region is in France. And we really enjoy the mountains and hiking, and we had previously had a lovely experience on the Swiss side of the same ranges, the same chunk of the Alps, and so we wanted to sort of experience the other side. And not to take anything away from the Swiss Alps, which had some of the most appealing hiking that I've experienced to that point in my life. But the mountains surrounding Chamonix are extraordinary. They have very different features. I won't get into it than the Rockies because they're older, but they're just remarkable. And one of the features that would prompt me to say that is the glaciers. As a Canadian, I've spent a fair bit of time in our own majestic mountains, so glaciers aren't a novelty to me, at least not in the sense of, you know, I've never seen anything like that before. I've seen several. I've spent time walking on them, climbing on them, camping on them. I've spent time with glaciers. But the concentration of glaciers and the remarkable access to them in this part of the world was just a next level experience for me. I'm not going to take up a lot of your time nerding out about this, but just to offer a little bit of context, just in that region, the Chamonix Mont Blanc area alone, there are 7 major and several minor glaciers. So there's like scads of glaciers just in and along this one chunk of valley, including sort of a famous one, the Mer de Glace, the Sea of Ice, which is the largest glacier in France, second largest in Europe. It's 7 kilometers long, about 40 square kilometers in area, about 200 meters thick. Now, that's a decent-sized glacier, but just in case you're curious, even if you're not, the largest glacier on what we might call European soil is located in Iceland, and it's freaking massive. It covers over 8,000 square kilometers, as distinct from 40, and accounts for about 8% of Iceland's landmass, hence, you know, Iceland. Anyway, the setting for all of this glacier gloriousness in Chamonix is the Mont Blanc Massif itself, tallest peak in Western Europe, and at 15,872-ish feet, the highest summit in the Alps. Which brings me to the point of all of this in our context. When you visit Chamonix, Mont Blanc is just always there. It's either kind of in your face or it's just over your shoulder. But when you're in Chamonix, it's just part of the landscape. You can see it from almost anywhere in town, including from the window of our perfectly adequate but not ostentatious accommodations. We didn't pay for the view. It was just there. So for us and for so many folks that both live and visit there, this reality, this presence of this massif and the related glaciers and the alpine terrain is delightful. It's inspiring. It's something to appreciate and it's something to celebrate. But that has not always been the case. And I don't mean that the mountain wasn't always there. I mean, in strictly geological terms, that's true enough. It hasn't always been there, but it's been there for a long time. What I mean is that for a period of history, quite a long period, in fact, it was like it was there, but people couldn't or wouldn't acknowledge it in a way that made it known outside of the valley. And for some of the big reasons that they couldn't or wouldn't do that were because of what they experienced relative to that mountain range and those glaciers, how they understood their experiences, and how the dominant religious systems that they taught them to think about or not think about what was right in front of their face. And I was unaware of this part of the mountain's history until we had the opportunity to take what one guidebook I looked at described as the most spectacular cable car in all of Europe, the Aiguille du Midi, which is just an absolutely remarkable. It is out one window, and it's just that all the way around. Like, there's no part of the view that isn't that. There's a series of two different, with a mid-station lifts that take you over the top of the range that Mont Blanc is in and out of France and into Italy. You can actually go down the other side and be in Italy if you choose to. Mont Blanc has its feet in both those countries. At the highest point in that journey, which is just over 12,600 feet, in the cable car station, there was a sign that had this engraving on it. It depicts the particular, the glacier that's above Chamonix as a dragon, a wicked worm with a U, as dragons were often referred to in the Middle Ages, coming down to devour the village that's in the valley. As an aside, this trip also provided several occasions to see up close how fast the glaciers are melting. It's a topic for another day, perhaps, but a truly startling experience when you can stand above a glacier and touch the place 50 meters above its present-day surface and talk with somebody who just happens to be standing there, who grew up in the area, who remembers coming up there on this little mountain train that gets you there and being able to walk off the train platform onto the glacier. Now the glacier is 50 meters lower than that and way up the valley. And we had a chance to be inside a glacier as well at one point, and to realize the rate at which these things are shrinking and sort of feel like you're present to that in a tangible way is kind of remarkable. In any case, the glacier below Mont Blanc used to reach right down into the valley, with some of the pieces that naturally come off the end, the seracs, tumbling right into the village. And so the sign that's below that engraving at that station describes it this way: Le Mont Maudit, Cursed Mountain, first appeared on a map to designate the Chamonix Valley and its high mountains. So the first notation that we have of this region just refers to it as the Cursed Mountain. And one of the reasons for that is because during the Little Ice Age, which is like 1599 to 1850, what happened is the glaciers grew a great deal during that time. And to a degree and in a way that actually surprised the valley's inhabitants, the people who'd lived there their whole lives. And so these seracs and avalanches and ice blocks would tumble off this glacier right down into the village. And that, as you can imagine, frightened both the visitors and the locals themselves. That's scary stuff for sure, right? So this glacier is nowhere near that now, having aggressively retreated for decades, including forming a very large hole in its tongue 2 years ago. So that's going to, you know, that's going to continue to be the case. But back then, the villagers were living with this glacier. It was right there. It was powerful. It was unpredictable. And it frightened people. And as we've considered in this space, when something frightens us as human beings, we often find it helpful to have a story for it that explains it. A way of thinking about it that gives it some place in the wider world of both our experience and our imagination. What are we encountering here? What does this mean? How will we think about it? So during this period of its history, late 1500s to mid-1800s, the explanation, the explainer story, was a spiritual one. This glacier was cursed, which is where the religious part of the story comes into clearer view. So generally speaking, this is a period of history where in this part of the world, church and state were deeply intertwined and held almost total power over the populace. Now, I'm touching on a really complicated period of history here, and I'm doing it in the context of illustrating a particular point, which means I'm going to make some sweeping generalizations. So if you're someone who cares about the intricacies of the French Revolution,
I want you to know that I'm trying to both move this along and also not be unfair to, you know, the dominant understandings of what took place during that period, about which there remains considerable debate. Not about what happened so much as about what caused it to happen. That's where the work continues. For our purposes, the point is that religious leaders, together with the monarchy, held a lot of power. They were part of the social elite. They were part of the group that had historically told people what to believe, and they had the power to enforce their preferences and their understanding of the universe on the populace. And so perhaps it's no surprise that when the glacier starts to misbehave, it's the bishops who show up, presumably because the local priests, you know, imprecations weren't getting the job done, to cast the demon out of the glacier, to exorcise the glacier. And then, as noted on the sign, in the 1630s, the plagues come as well. We visited a village in our travels that had had half of its population die in 4 days during this time. We stayed in another where if a ship arrived during that time, the ship was burned and its inhabitants were quarantined in a house along with the local lepers. So again, like scary stuff, right? And in an age of superstition, the sort of experience that demanded an explanation, that just our humanness cries out for that, under those kind of, that kind of duress, and the religious authorities of the day provided one. As the sign says, this rendered the area, quote, inhospitable and isolated. Mont Blanc remained unknown. I mean, would you want to go visit somewhere overshadowed by a demonic glacier? And perhaps, though, this is also a reasonable example of lost in translation, because it's not truly unknown, is it? That's an interesting translation. The villagers know it. It tumbles down on their cottages and crushes them. The bishops know it. They invoke the power of the divine to exorcise the demon within it, to drive it back where it came from. And after they come and pray over it, they go back to their grand Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, right? But the wider world doesn't know it. It remains unknown. It's hiding in plain sight. One of the reasons my, you know, grab-and-go cell phone photo of that sign is so out of kilter is because, I mean, I took it, a note of it, enough to say I want to remember this, to grab a picture of it, but I grabbed it just as I walked by. And it wasn't until I thought about it later that I was struck by some of the implications of it for what we do here together, because you're all in my suitcase. Let me frame it this way. When the French Revolution came along in the late 1700s, one of the reasons it happened, number 6 on the list I looked up, not the first one or the second one, but it was on there. One of the reasons it happened is because the populace was increasingly unwilling to believe that the monarchy was divinely ordained. That was losing its grip. And along with that, no longer inclined to respond to the church and its leadership as speaking for God or with the authority of the divine. And one of the reasons for that shift was the growing rise of a scientific understanding of the world. It's an aside, but I think it's an interesting one in context. The first two folks who summited Mont Blanc in 1786 were a local scientist, they're both from the valley, a local scientist and a local crystal collector. So both guys who'd grown up with the mythology that said the glacier's a demon, if you go out there it eats you, you don't come back, right? But they were motivated really differently. One was motivated primarily by scientific curiosity, and this guy ended up climbing Mont Blanc 34 times, set up a research station up there. Like, he, you know, there's a statue of him in the middle of the main square. But accompanied by the crystal gatherer, for whom this was primarily motivated by money, because there was a merchant from Geneva who wanted to climb Mont Blanc but didn't know how, and so he offered this cash reward for anybody who could get to the summit, because he figured if somebody could get there, they could come and show him how to get there, right? So there was this cash prize sitting out there. Lots of failures before there was a success. But in the end, these two folks do the job. And their diverse mindsets, like what motivated the two characters who get there first in terms of summiting this thing, from the point of view of history, that this is a cursed mountain, the fact that we got a crystal collector and a scientist that are the first summiters just kind of makes me grin. Anyway, now we've got this, the story starting to shift. So now that looming collective of rock and snow and ice is not only known as opposed to unknown, but it's a place that people were increasingly intrigued to explore, to know better. These guys, it's an interesting story because the crystal collector had sort of tried it with a group on his own. The group had turned back. He got left out there. He had to bivouac overnight on the rock. He had to spend the night, which nobody believed you could survive. it wasn't actually that long ago that nobody believed you could get to the top of Everest without oxygen and still be able to function as a human when you came down, right? We know different now. But until he did that and came back, people were like, that's impossible. So this is an important part of the shift that's happening here, right? So what happens is once these two guys get there, this whole mythology that said the demon's going to eat you if you go up there was demonstrably not true. They did. They came back. And they had told people to watch the summit with the telescopes from the valley because you can see it. So they could see that they had done this. So eventually, this mountain and the Chamonix Valley become what one guidebook I read called the spiritual birthplace of mountaineering. And today, if you ride that cable car up into this region, you're going to be sharing the car with lots of folks who are in their full alpine gear. They're busy strapping on their crampons because they're riding up there so they can go out and spend a day on the glaciers. Right? And when you come back to the lift station, it's covered in wet mountaineering gear. Everybody's drying out from a day on the glacier. And that is a profound shift from this thing is cursed and we need God to fix it, so we better call a bishop, isn't it? That's a different space. What was once feared now holds a place of honor, of intrigue, of potential adventure, even a sort of reverence. What was once turned away from in fear now invites exploration, whether that's from a distance or up close. So, I said I was going to end with a question. So here's my question for our consideration. In this setting, at the table, that exists to encourage and support the exploration of belief, I would be interested to know, what are some, I'm going to say, remarkable things, ideas, experiences, beliefs, that were sort of kept hidden in plain sight in your life experience because someone or some system of belief that you regarded or experienced as authoritative told you they were dangerous, perhaps even cursed, in the sense that the Chamonix villagers regarded the glacier as cursed. They were a hazard to you, and there was a spiritual reason why they were a hazard. Or, as a sort of corollary question, what were or maybe are some, you know, wicked worms that are perhaps no more and no less than the unfamiliar or the challenging or the unknown in your life experience that are waiting to be explored? When you look at them, they have that cast about them of being dangerous in some way that's spiritualized. I'm going to leave that there for the podcast and say peace, and here's something for you to reflect on if you're listening to this on the podcast, and we're going to carry on and have our own conversation about it here in person, which obviously you'd be welcome to join if you have the opportunity.